They are elected by you. I am elected by you. I'm constrained as they are constrained by a system that our founders put in place.
The founders separated power because they knew it was the best way to protect our citizens.
They didn't want one person, one man to have all the power like a king.
We show by our work that free people can govern themselves.
You can't pay lip service to the Constitution without obeying it.
Keep your eye on the ball. Structure is destiny.
This is Necessary and Proper, the podcast of the Federal Society's Article 1 Initiative. All views expressed on this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the Federal Society. Hello and welcome again to Necessary and Proper. This is Nate Kaczmarek, and I'm thrilled to be joined by a friend of the Federal Society and the Article 1 Initiative, Chris DeMuth. Chris, thank you for being here with us. It's a real privilege to have you.
It's good to be here, Nate. Thanks.
Other than it being swampy, 90 degrees and humid, everything else all right with you?
Just fine. Yeah, thank you.
Great. Before we get rolling, I just wanted to touch a little bit on your background. Chris is very accomplished, and we don't have time to run down his entire career in detail. But quickly, he's a Harvard grad, former staff assistant to President Nixon, University of Chicago law grad, Administrator for Information and Regulatory Affairs in the Office of Management and Budget during the Reagan administration. Was it always called OIRA from the start?
Yes, it's a statutory office. It was created by the Paperwork Reduction Act of 1980,
okay,
signed by Jimmy Carter in December of 1980, just as he was leaving town. The enrolled bill memo arrived at his desk told him that every member of the cabinet advised that he should veto this law because it was going to stand in the way of all sorts of important regulatory and information collection initiatives around the federal government. And President Carter said, "It's this kind of thing that makes me glad I'm getting out of this town." A month later, Ronald Reagan came in, and he took this piece of this statutory office and expanded its writ to cover not just paperwork collection, such as IRS forms and so forth, but regulatory impositions as well. And it has been used by every subsequent president, including Presidents Obama mm-hmm. and Trump, as the sort of statutory authority for the president's oversight of the regulatory activities of the executive branch.
Mm-hmm. And arguably one of the more powerful offices that a lot of folks out in the country aren't aware of.
That's true. And the folks out there, there's no reason they have to study these things. it's okay not to follow these details. But for people for scholarly reasons or business reasons or lawyers that study the work of the executive branch, mm-hmm. Any able practitioner knows a good deal about OIRA and the work that it does.
Sure. Thereafter, you were president of the American Enterprise Institute from 1986 to 2008 and a senior fellow at AEI from 2008 to 2011. You are presently a distinguished fellow at the Hudson Institute here in Washington, D.C. Again, as I said, he has a very distinguished career. We couldn't cover all the details, but I just wanted to make sure, orient our audience before we get rolling.
But Nate, you've neglected the most important part of my career. I am co-chairman of the visiting committee of the Federalist Society.
Another powerful office. So I wanted to talk today a little bit about our current Congress. We're here in mid-July 2017, more than 6 months into the 115th, and almost at the summer recess. I'm first interested in your general thoughts on how the new Congress is doing.
I think that there's some good and there's some bad. But for people who have been longstanding students of Congress and the problems that this important institution has wandered into in recent decades, one has to say as of halfway through the first year of the new dispensation, President Trump and a Republican Senate and House, that there are many worrisome signs. Mm-hmm. Those who are concerned about the role of Congress in our constitutional system have a story. I could call it a theory or, you know, an account or a conventional wisdom, but there's just a view that Congress since the 60s and the 70s is not the institution that it used to be, mm-hmm. It does not engage in deliberation, legislation, as it had for many, many decades, actually about 175 years, going back to the first Congress in 1789. It is often remarked that Congress has not passed a regular budget using its own budget procedures for decades. Mm-hmm. And you could find one or two years in there when they sort of came close, but the idea that we begin a fiscal year by saying now the next fiscal year that begins in the fall, we're going to set revenues, we're going to have an estimate of revenues, we're going to set our budget, and then we're going to allocate the budget amongst various public purposes. This is not done, it was done for a very long period of time. In the area of regulation, which has been my specialty as an academic, and I worked on regulatory policy for Mr. Reagan for several years, Congress has increasingly avoided making hard legislative decisions. Congress will pass a law that stands up boldly and bravely in favor of clean air and safe products, and forthrightly opposed to discrimination against the handicapped and unsound financial practices. But they're not really making any decisions. They are associating themselves with velleities, with just sort of things that everybody agrees with. Mm-hmm. The hard decisions are made downtown in the agencies that have to decide exactly how to accomplish these noble but pretty uncontroversial goals. And we think about the growth of regulation as going back to the progressive era. Law students will study the Interstate Commerce Commission and the Federal Trade Commission in the Woodrow Wilson administration, and then the coming of the New Deal and the Securities and Exchange Commission and the CAB that regulated airlines and so forth. But those were commissions and agencies that had a fairly narrow ambit. They would make decisions such as whether an additional airline could fly between Los Angeles and Tulsa. The new agencies, the Environmental Protection Agency, NHTSA, the Highway Traffic Safety Administration, others that came on in the late 60s and the 1970s, made huge decisions of costs and benefits of tens, sometimes hundreds of millions of dollars, covering the whole economy. And they didn't do it through court-like adjudicative procedures. They did it through rulemaking, which was something that was unheard of in the Wilson administration, in the Roosevelt administration. It almost did not exist as a species of lawmaking until the early 1970s. And Congress just stood by as more and more de facto legislative power migrated out of Congress and into the executive branch. This achieved some extremes under the George W. Bush administration, but the greatest by far in the Obama administration, mm-hmm. Where the president, President Obama, was very clear about his intent to use executive power in a way that had been that was quite naked and that was unattached to statutory law or policy, simply because he was frustrated that Congress was not enacting his agenda. So a lot of longstanding academic complaints and worries about Congress and books that had accumulated, The Broken Branch, acquired, it really became part of the Republican gospel mm-hmm. when the Democrats were in charge in the Senate and in the White House, that we had this unfettered executive that needed to be reined in. Mm-hmm. So suddenly we have this surprise election in last year, the election of 2016. And it seemed at the beginning, and it may turn out to be this way, that it was an auspicious time for the Congress to reassert itself, for members of Congress to stand up for the rights of the place, to think about themselves as institutionalists, as belonging to a independent branch of the federal government. And the reason is that we had a unified government in a nominal sense. One party, the Republican Party, was in control of both political branches and within the Congress, both chambers. And yet, there were big differences between the traditional Republican Party and this new Republican president, who had run against Congress as an institution. Congress was part of the swamp. He attacked Republicans with at least as much zeal as he attacked the Democrats. He had many views that were antithetical to Republican Party doctrine, especially on trade, some aspects of immigration, some other areas. So there was real suspicion, institutional suspicion and jealousy between the branches. So you would expect that Congress would really assert itself, mm-hmm. that they would work with the president. They were part of the same party. Their fortunes were linked to some extent. And yet, for such things as passing a budget, for taking more control over the affairs of the federal government, you would have expected to have seen the Congress be much more assertive than it has in its first several months. Now, it has asserted itself in certain areas. I would say that the Senate's deliberation and decision on the nomination of Judge Neil Gorsuch to be a justice of the Supreme Court, which involved moving the Senate to being a majority vote institution rather than a 60-vote institution when it comes to the confirmation or non-confirmation of all appointees, both to executive branch and judicial positions. That was a big triumph, I think, for the Republicans, mm-hmm. Both in the executive branch and Congress. Congress has repealed 14 major rulemaking regulatory programs of the executive branch under the Congressional Review Act. Also, a loophole in the Senate filibuster procedures. In all 14 of those cases, Congress could act with the Senate voting only. All they needed was 51 votes, not 60 votes, in the Senate. And all of those, these were major decisions, some of them highly controversial. And the Republicans were quite cohesive. But the vote, they only got a few Democratic votes. And the vote was less than 60 in every one of them. But those were dramatic. That was Congress being very effective. But you see, in both of these cases, they are reacting to the executive branch. Mm-hmm. They're not actually making legislation themselves. And in the big area of making legislation, Obamacare, repeal and replace, an initiative that all Republicans, when in opposition, have dedicated themselves to for 5, 6, 7 years, they have been unable to legislate. They've been unable to come together to practice the core responsibility of the Congress, which is to hold hearings on a matter of national importance and controversy, to come to a decision and to legislate. And legislation is, let me put it, it is hard work, mm-hmm. and it is never fun, because it involves everybody having to vote for something that they don't like. Everybody. And when legislation is finished, almost everybody's a little bit grumpy and unhappy with other people because they were forced to make people. Nobody likes to compromise their principles and or interests. But that is what legislation is all about. It is what Congress has become poorer and poorer at doing in decades. And it is quite remarkable that the Republicans have not been able to find the votes that they needed within another filibuster loophole where the Senate can act by a majority, just as the House can, to vote on Obamacare. You can say that, well, they're not going to get any votes from the Democrats. And that's true. This is an unusual case because the Democrats voted in Obamacare on a party line vote. It is the signature achievement of the Obama administration. It is wildly controversial. The Republicans did very well by opposing it. And yet they've not been able, they have to do it themselves. They're not going to get any help from across the aisle. They've known right. that all along. But they do have majorities in both houses. And it's remarkable that the differences, which are not huge among the Republicans, have been such that they've been unable to legislate. They've also been missing deadlines on passing a budget for the 2018 fiscal year that begins now in October. We're roaring up to that, and the idea that they are going to pass regular appropriations for the federal government by October 1st, nobody thinks that's going to happen. They've been talking a lot about tax legislation, but that remains to be seen. And many other important matters, immigration law, an infrastructure bill of some sort. Essentially, very, very little has happened. So this was more of a lecture than just an answer to a question that you tossed at me. But you said, how has Congress been doing? And I think if you look at the past 30 or 40 years, when Congress seems to have lost its ability to perform its essential legislative functions. And then suddenly we have conditions where you might think it might step up. It's not, the Congress is not trying to stop the president. They're of the same party. Right. Partisan considerations should pull them together. And yet there's a certain amount of suspicion, so you'd think Congress would behave as a real independent institution. And, you know, you go back to the, say, the 1950s or the 1960s when the Democrats, held Congress and the executive branch. The leaders in Congress loved to stand up to the president of their own party. That showed how important they were in this town.
Right.
And they loved to say no to the president or force the president to make this compromise or that compromise. We had a functioning separation of powers that acted differently than the separation of than partisan considerations, and we seem to have lost that. And a lot of people who are students of Article I and would like to bring back Congress as an independent constitutional organ for larger purposes of the national interest, I have to be a bit concerned that we don't see more of that happening under conditions which, you know, one would have thought if we're going to see a congressional revival, mm-hmm. now would be it.
Right.
And we don't see it yet.
Right. It's a very unified government, but ultimately, at this point, very fractured.
It's fractured, but Congress is not legislating. It is not budgeting. It is not appropriating.
Right.
And maybe things will change. Maybe it takes time. Maybe I'm just being too impatient. But I notice that the big successes that people talk about that Congress has. You read the newspapers and people say, well, on these issues, the Congress is unified. No, I see them reacting to the executive under conditions where the Senate is not facing a filibuster. And that's easy. When the Congress has to legislate and when it has to get 60 votes in the Senate, now we're talking hard, real hard legislative challenges, and it hasn't happened yet.
So let me ask you this question for the outside observer who maybe doesn't pay as close attention as you do, who doesn't really have a high opinion of Congress, but understands that it's not functioning as it should be. Who cares? Why should it matter to them as a citizen if the Congress isn't fulfilling their role? What is the need for an Article I initiative like ours in the first place?
One reason is that more and more we are living under laws that are not sanctioned by our representatives. And I don't want to sound too theoretical or kind of hoity-toity or too much like a Washington insider that wants everybody out there across the country to pay attention to all the really important things that we do. But, you know, we do have this Constitution, and it involves a sort of an implicit agreement among all of us that we should understand that the laws that we agree to live under are laws that people that represent us have agreed to. And that's a really, really big deal. For most of the history of humankind, the laws that people have lived under have been the laws that have been dictated to them by kings and tyrants. And for most of the people who live on the planet today, the laws that they live under are dictated to them by kings and tyrants. We have a different form of government. It's called democracy. It's called Republican government. We actually get to set our own course. Is it perfect? Absolutely not. It's very, very difficult. Most people don't pay that much attention to politics. When they do, and they watch the news reports about what's going on in Washington, they're horrified and they want to go back to sports or their hobbies or their businesses or family life or music or whatever. Right. However, there are certain responsibilities of citizenship. Mm-hmm. And one of them is that we all agree that the laws that are made by Republican institutions are laws that we are going to respect and live under, because we recognize that in a country as big and diverse, heterogeneous, in many respects fractious as ours, there are going to be many, many important issues upon which we disagree. Mm-hmm. And all of us have to find a way to live in a society along with people civilly at peace with people that disagree with us. Okay,
right.
This is part of being a modern citizen. And so it is important that we feel that the laws that are being handed down that we agree to obey have been made by compromise, that the people representing our point of view, he might be your congressman or senator, maybe not, maybe you can't stand your representative and your senator, but there's somebody in there who stands up for what you believe in, he or she will do the best that they can, but they're going to have to compromise, and they're going to end up with laws, and then we're going to all live by them. But most of our laws today are not made in that way. They're made by highly specialized, mission-oriented, highly zealous regulatory agencies one kind or another.
Right, and I was going to ask you about that. There are some who say, well, maybe it's better that the car salesman from your local neighborhood who maybe doesn't have experience running a budget like ours or some of the issues that are at the federal level is being usurped, that really it's better that so-called experts in the administrative agencies who've been educated to do that work are doing that work. And your response to them is?
Well, the idea of government by experts always sat uncomfortably with the constitutional scheme. And there are many people who will say, yes, it's much better to have expert, scientific, disinterested people making our laws than parochial, partisan, uninformed non-experts, which is what the people in Congress. You will hear people say that.
Sure.
However, almost everybody, even people that have that view, it's so easy to give them five or six examples of regulatory excess where the experts in the bureaucracy have done really dumb things. The experts in the bureaucracy brought us the financial collapse of 2008. That was not a great application of expertise. we have many, many policies handed down by the expert agencies that are very bad policies. And one might say that it is certainly the case that one reason for Donald Trump's surprise victory last year was that people were just sort of fed up with people in Washington thinking that they knew more than the average Joe or Jane down at the local auto repair shop or donut shop. I don't want to say that there's nothing to expertise. There are difficult questions where you want to have people with a lot of training and understanding to making decisions. But when you have one layer of government accumulating as much power as ours has, you are going to have a lot of arrogance and excess. And we've got a lot of that, and it's a good reason for a lot of the disillusionment with government out in the hinterlands, outside of the Beltway, is highly justified. Mm-hmm. It is not irrational. It is not just sort of partisan suspicion of elites. It is not know-nothing populism. It is based in a well-grounded skepticism about the actual performance of our government.
So safe to say it's your view that these experts should be sharing their expertise with our elected officials.
I think that there should be a balance between representativeness, people that are representing average folks in the Congress, and the sorts of expert judgments that some people sometimes in. Probably half the regulatory, I'm somewhat extreme, about half the regulatory agencies I'd be happy to see go away. Do I think that the federal government should police the introduction of new pharmaceuticals into the healthcare system? Yes, I do.
I see.
And do I think that the federal government has an important role in environmental protection? Yes, I do. So I think that there are important roles there, but I think that the bureaucracies tend toward extremes, and they need to be counterbalanced with the viewpoint of average common sense viewpoints of people in Congress, and they're not getting that today.
Well, I'd say that was a pretty good report card on the institution of Congress and also the 115th so far. While I have you on the record, would you like to make any predictions about the 115th going forward after the recess here and their ability or inability to address some of these Article I issues?
No. if I were able to predict the future, I'd be in New York working in the financial markets. And if I like to predict the future, I would be on some television talk show where pundits pontificate. But no, I'm not. I don't know. I mean, one. I think that there are a lot of people in the Congress that that understand the nature of the problems that I've discussed, mm-hmm. and they're working very hard on it. Mm-hmm. But I think that the nature of Congress has changed, and recovering some semblance of a true competition of powers within the federal structure reviving true lawmaking powers in the Congress, I think it is very, very difficult, and I think that there are, I think that the obstacles to achieving it are quite high.
Very good, understood. I thought maybe we'd shift gears a little bit in our conversation. I know that one of the aspects of Congress that you have been focused on more recently is this idea of fiscal restraint. And the fact that from 1789 until now, there's been a dramatic change in the way Congress views its own financial process and responsibility for the power of the purse. In that context, what is different about the period from 1789 to roughly the 1960s and the 1960s to now?
I will answer that, but let me first give you a segue or a little word about why it is that I am interested in this.
Sure.
Nate, you asked me a few minutes ago, why should average folks care, you know, about this? Is it sounds like a lot of inside baseball, and what mm-hmm. difference does it really make? I think that the quantity, quality, integrity of our laws that we have to live under, which I emphasized, is important. But I think equally important is that with the decline of Congress has been a dramatic decline in responsibility for the finances of the federal government, which have, given the government size, an enormous effect on our economic welfare and on the future. And in particular, that Congress has lost, I think it's fair to say, all sense of fiscal restraint and propriety. Let me explain what I mean by that.
Sure. Please do.
If you look at the Constitution, if you look at Article 1, which is what this initiative of the Federalist Society is concerned with, what is often called the power of the purse is actually much broader. It's a breathtaking grant of authority to the legislative branch. The legislative branch, the federal is responsible for all tax policy. And by the way, while we're at it, tax policy has to originate with the House of Representatives. The folks that are closest to the voters have to face the electorate every 2 years. You can't have a tax bill that doesn't begin with the House of Representatives. No money may be borrowed except with the permission of Congress. No money may be appropriated from the Treasury for any purpose without an appropriation from Congress. Congress holds all of the chips where fiscal policy is concerned. And and it has been astoundingly negligent in exercising these powers in recent decades. To put a little background to it, in response to what you said, for the first 175 years of the Republic, Congress exercised these constitutional powers quite responsibly. it was not unilateral congressional government. The executive has always played a big role in fashioning an annual budget. From the day that Alexander Hamilton arrived in New York City halfway through the first session of the Congress, halfway through the first Congress, the executive branch has played a big role in proposing tax legislation, spending, negotiating, and so forth and so on. However, Congress jealously guarded its ability to control borrowing, the contours of tax policy, and the total appropriations of the federal government year in and year out. And during that period, it was a pretty good steward. That is, it pursued a policy that I think most people would say is a sensible policy. And it is a policy that says, we're going to begin, our default position is going to be pay as you go. We're going to have a balanced budget every year. The federal government's not going to spend anything except by dint of taxing it from current taxpayers. Okay? Now, we're going to depart from that in a couple of cases. a war where we've got to raise money really, really fast, a really attractive investment opportunity, the Louisiana Purchase, other territorial purchases. That was, we borrowed Jefferson against his better instincts, I should say against his strong instincts, borrowed $11 million, which was just really one of the great reasons for borrowing, one of the great investments that that's ever been made. The Transcontinental Railroad, the canals, although they were mainly financed at the local level, but they were financed with borrowing. And when you're going to, when you're building a long-lived capital asset, spreading the responsibility for paying for it over several the generations that will be using the asset makes perfect sense. And then finally, when we simply ran into a recession and suddenly revenues were falling faster than we realized it, are you going to fire people or are you going to count on the economy's coming back next year? So they would borrow to get through bad times even before the depression of the 1930s. However, when they accumulated debts for wars or investments or economic bad times, everybody agreed that we were going to pay it off as in short order, not necessarily right away, but you know, over, if you had huge debts, War of 1812, you know, it took a couple of decades to pay all that off, but you were earnest about it and you paid a little bit off and you worked down the debt, and everybody was for that. Hamilton and Jefferson, Herbert Hoover and Franklin D. Roosevelt, John Maynard Keynes was in favor of that.
Right.
Everybody was sort of a budget balancer over the long or intermediate term. And Congress followed that pretty consistently, pretty consistently. Beginning in the 1960s and with much, much greater force, consistency in recent decades, Congress has given up on annual appropriations. Most, a very large part of federal spending is now not appropriated at all. Two-thirds of it is entitlement spending, where spending is governed by statutory formulas, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, food stamps, other expenditures. It simply defines categories of people that may get money from the federal government. And if you fit that category, you fill out the form, you send it in, you're going to get the money. I'm speaking broadly, but that's essentially, it's not dependent upon annual appropriations.
Right.
And even the one-third, military spending, judges' salaries, the National Institutes of Health, even the part that is appropriated really is not appropriated anymore because the Congress doesn't pass appropriation bills. They pass one big blunderbuss continuing resolution 2 weeks or 2 days or 2 minutes before the next fiscal year is about to begin. And they simply took what they did last year and they make some percentage changes. They make a couple of tweaks. They fire a shot across the bow of Planned Parenthood or some other pariah. But they're not fashioning appropriations. Congress is not actually using the appropriations process to make policy. And year in and year out, they simply don't do that anymore. There are many cases where now borrowing and taxation is being handed over to the executive branch as well. During this period, we have put aside the idea of fiscal restraint, which means beginning with the default rule of balancing the books and then borrowing in specific cases where it's justified and paying down those debts as you can in better times or over longer periods of time. We don't do that anymore. Since the late 60s, when we started running kind of planned deficits. Then in the 70s, we started having routine deficits. And in the 80s, they became large routine deficits. And since then, it's just hundreds of billions of dollars every year. And it's not, we've had some wars. We've had some investment opportunities. Remember Solyndra? Mm-hmm. We've had some We've had some recessions. But for the most part, we're not borrowing money to either get ourselves through hard times or to expand the future through investment or defenses against foreign aggression. We're simply financing current consumption. We're borrowing huge amounts of money to finance a fairly generous welfare state of transfer payments from some citizens to other citizens. We think of it as a transfer from some citizens to others, but we politicians of all stripes debate it as if it were a transfer system from some to others. So, for example, Democrats talk about we're going to raise taxes on the wealthy so we can pay for programs for worthy people of lower incomes, or we're going to tax corporations. But a very large share of the welfare state is being funded simply by borrowing from people that haven't been born yet. Mm-hmm. And borrowing for wars or to get through bad times or for investments doesn't always turn out well. Half of wars on average are lost, right? The government is not very good at making investments, and it makes a lot of bad investments. Some good, but it loses a lot. It makes some unsuccessful ones. But if you're just spending money on current consumption, which most of the welfare state is, not entirely, but it's mostly consumption, not investment, the idea that we're enlarging the future or defending our future, it's not there. We're constraining our future. We're making it smaller, and it is going to collapse. It is unsustainable, and it is going to come crashing down, and a lot of innocent people are going to get hurt. And that is my current paper is accounting for why we are doing that. But it is the largest reason why people that don't pay it, that are blissfully, you know, ignorant, it's not really the right word, but blissfully disengaged,
right,
from inside Washington politics, should be concerned about the form of government that we've created. It's a form of government that is spending huge amounts of money that are borrowed from the future, and that are constraining and diminishing the American future, and that are even having big effects today. I mean, one of the reasons that the Trump administration is dealing with so many great difficulties in foreign policy is that we have a very small defense budget, and even the Trump proposal is not for a very much larger defense budget. And the reason is that to speak fairly broadly, we're broke. We don't have the money. Mm-hmm. If we're going to do more in defense, it's just borrowing money in the face of trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars of effective debt today, which is dragging our economy down.
So is it that Congress has, from roughly the 60s forward, started to reflect what they've seen in the culture? Or is it that the leaders that we've elected have learned that they could game the system in ways that were constitutional but maybe detrimental to future generations? I assume there are multiple factors, and you've walked through some of them.
There are many layers of explanation, and one that I think is an important part of it is what you allude to, which I call the expressive explanation in the paper that I've done for the Federalist Society, mm-hmm. And that is that Congress is just representative. It's not, you know, we have a normative theory of the proper role of the judge,
right,
and we have, you know, pretty highly defined view of what we want the president to be. If you read the Constitution, the president's job is to defend the Constitution. If we look at the modern presidency, he's also to be a national leader. So we have but Congress just represents. And there was a long period of time when the norm of fiscal responsibility was actually a technique for these mythical people Nate, that you and I have been talking, these sturdy, wonderful people outside the Beltway, between the two coasts, who are, live by the rules, raise their family, you know, the salt of the earth, the people we
That's
admire.
Right.
It was the norm, the rule of fiscal responsibility. It was their rule. And you could say, well, they were so ignorant. They didn't know. They weren't sophisticated to know that government is not like the family balancing the checkbook, you know, at the dinner, over the kitchen table, the husband and wife setting out the, it's very difficult. It's very different. It's more complicated than that. Actually, it was very simple. What the average person that didn't have enough time to follow government knew was this. He or she knew that they did not like to pay taxes and that they knew their neighbors didn't like to pay taxes either. There's just a resistance to paying taxes, and that in a world of fiscal responsibility is itself a limit on government,
right?
Because the government can't spend what it doesn't convince people to give to it, including representatives who have to face the voters every 2 years. They've got to convince people to give the money government to give money in revenues. So if you have a regime of fiscal responsibility, that is a discipline on government. It is a discipline on corruption, on cronyism, on governments, on mission creep, getting involved in things, whether it is wars or welfare payments. It's simply a constraint.
Right.
And you can be out there, and as long as everybody is abiding by this constraint, you actually don't have to follow the details beyond the fact that you know that for these guys in Washington, raising money is tough. But what happened was the people in government started figuring out a different approach. I think they found in little incremental steps, beginning in the 1960s, they made a discovery that if you begin to pay for government with borrowing, you get yourself into a different world. And this different world is a world where all of us as citizens become used to receiving higher levels of benefits from the government than we're paying in taxes to get them. So if you take the polity, the citizenry as a whole, borrowing from the future actually makes things pretty nice in the present. And I think it's been a bad habit. We've acquired a bad habit. And it was just, you know, we had a few cigarettes a day and it was kind of fun, or we had a few drinks a day or something like that. But it has gone to excess, and working our way back, a government that is as big as, we can't, cold turkey is actually not an option because so many people have become dependent on government and on higher levels of expenditure than we could possibly tax from currently living citizens. So it has to be tapered, you know, it's like going to AA, Borrowers Anonymous, or I don't know what. So it's a lot more complicated. So
I think Winston Churchill referred to it as making economies, and that meant that he could no longer have his Dundee cakes after every
<that's>
afternoon.
Right.
So I think it's a little more severe,
yes,
in this sense.
So I think that there has been this fact that that Congress has figured out a way around a traditional restraint. But I think if you'll let me go on for just one other minute, I think that there's another aspect to it, and that is that Congress has itself been adapting to very changed circumstances of modern society. And that is a society where of very great affluence, where large numbers of people have a lot of leisure time, where transportation and communications technologies have made it possible, in the words of economists, the transaction costs of politics have fallen. Mm-hmm. People can form lobbying groups, pressure groups, much, much easier. People in politics can organize their political careers independently of the power structures of Congress or parties in a way that could never be done in the past. All of these changes have combined to produce demands for government intervention in the economy that are vastly greater than the institutions of our Constitution contemplated. We all say that the framers contemplated a much, you know, more limited realm of the federal government. But just to put it in those dry terms, it does not really capture the extent to which thousands and thousands of minute causes press themselves upon every member of Congress and every staff and all of the time, and have transformed the life of anybody in Congress. It is an extraordinarily hectic time to keep up with all of the demands. And I think that the atomization of Congress, the fact that Congress has become so entrepreneurial at the individual level, and the atomization of the demand side, that we have an infinity of groups that want one thing or another out of the government, has led to two forms of adaptation. One is in lawmaking that we discussed at the beginning of this conversation. Congress is just simply delegating decision-making to hierarchical executive agencies. It's very costly for two nested committees, the Congress and the Senate, committee decision making. Everybody that's ever, you know, sat on a, you know, a vestry of a church or been in a committee of some local voluntary organization, some knows that it's very, very tedious and difficult to sort out differences and come to a consensus. There's no way that Congress, no matter how it was organized, could master all of the demands that are placed on it. So when it comes to lawmaking, they simply set up a new agency. You can set up as many agencies as you want. You can keep up with all the demands. Somebody's got some new issue. I can't figure that out. Let's just set up some agency and put it in a department somewhere. Let them figure it out. Right. When it comes to spending, the demands that as I have said, I think that Congress is complicit in this and somewhat to blame, but it has certainly created a world where there are demands for government spending far beyond the society's ability to pay for it on a year-to-year basis. So we just borrow it. And I will say that I am a Republican, and, you know, I've got my own political views and so forth, but these problems, the scary thing is that they are highly bipartisan in nature. You know, if you take all of the budget reforms and spending reductions of all of the Republican House committees of the past couple of years and you put them together, it doesn't make a dent. Well, that's a little bit strong. It doesn't make a dent, and it makes a dent starting 20 or 30 years from now, which means that it is highly speculative, and it is a kind of a part of trying to kick the can down the road in a somewhat better direction. But still, there has been this adaptation, and there are lots of things about modern life and communications and transportation and affluence and leisure time that are wonderful. I'm not saying that these are scourges. They are what make living in 2017 this is the place to be, let me tell you. But it has a lot of it has some bad side effects, and we have to adapt our political systems more effectively to the world that we're in.
And so do you have, at this point, some suggested solutions for these dilemmas?
I don't have any total solutions, right. Final solutions, wave of the wand, if we just do this, mm-hmm. Do that. Because of the depth of these problems, I'm very I'm very aware of the there's a difficulty in all reform programs of circularity. A professor of mine once said that most proposals for reform are on the model of the solution to the problem of drunkenness is greater temperance in the consumption of alcohol. So if I say the solution to the deficit problem is a balanced budget amendment, if we passed that and we followed it, the problem would go away. But of course, the problem itself is that we don't want it, that it would be very, very unpopular. Right. So, and most academics think the balanced budget amendment's a terrible idea, because what happens when a war comes along? Or, you know, sometimes you have to borrow money, and it would lead to all sorts of problems. We've got states with I think Illinois's got a balanced budget. I think California's got a balanced budget amendment. You know, thank you very much. That was effective, wasn't it? But, and we'll find ways around it in Washington as well. I'm actually in favor of a balanced budget amendment because I think it would be a great vehicle for public education. And I think that when it comes to public education, just saying, well, I think we should teach kindergartners about the fiscal problem that is my, you know, that I'm occupying my adult career worrying about, you know, that's not going to happen. But if some live politicians, the way Ronald Reagan did when he was president, you could attack them for being hypocritical because they'd be making decisions today in the Congress or in the White House that were inconsistent with a balanced budget amendment. But if they pushed it hard, it would more people would pay attention to the fix that we're in. In Congress, I am a great fan of restoring much more of a hierarchy such as we had in the past. I would like very strong committees. I think that the ideas of writing major legislation in the party leader's office with a bunch of staff people, whether it's a continuing resolution or the fifth stab at replacing and repealing and replacing Obamacare for governing a very large sector of the economy, I think that the process of lawmaking has to begin with at the committee level, with investigations, with education, with doing a lot of research, with building a case. And I think that you get effective bipartisan cooperation in the context of a committee that's working on the transportation problem or that is working on the problem of infectious diseases, you know, or something very, very specific that engages people's practical instincts, so that the fact that you're a member of the evil Republican Party and I'm a member of the hyper-virtuous Democratic Party, you kind of, it becomes a little bit less important. Mm-hmm. And then pretty soon you've got a committee that agrees on something in tax reform, and the party can't say, absolutely not. Do not compromise with people from the other parties. Harry Reid was, he pulled the rug out of several Democrats that were starting to work with Republicans in the last Congress. And I think it was one of the worst aspects of his tenure. And I would like to see, and I see some of it, especially in Paul Ryan in the House, in permitting the committees and especially the committee chairs to have much more say about the development of legislation. I think decentralization, mm-hmm. subsidiarity, I think those are powerful principles in society. And if you build a hierarchy out of that, pretty soon you have a legislature that can make decisions and can stand up to the inherently hierarchical executive branch. So I want to see stronger hierarchies. That are policy rather than partisan hierarchies. I think that's the sine qua non of return to both lawmaking and annual budgeting.
Very good. I'm wondering if we could transition quickly to another topic, which is, and I don't mean to put you on the spot, but for the law student, Hill staffer, or concerned citizen who's listening in, if they want to quickly get a better understanding of the importance of Congress,
How is it designed to function and why? Other than, of course, the Article I materials that we have, where would you send them to find out more and research on their own?
There are very few good sources. Mm-hmm. If you read The Hill, Roll Call, finding out what is happening on the Hill, mm-hmm. there are some reporters that cover some of the issues I've described pretty well. Mm-hmm. My recommendation for the Hill staffer or the person in law school would be to go to some of the greatest of the students of the Congress. I think that there are some excellent ones out there now. If I just mention a couple of names, I think that they will they would get lost. Mm-hmm. But here's where to start. There was a great political scientist at Harvard University named Samuel Huntington. You can Google Samuel Huntington. It's very, very easy. And he wrote a great many important books on many aspects of American policy and culture. But he wrote a great piece about the Congress called The Problem. I forget what the title was. But he wrote a piece in 1965 about the nature of the Congress, and I would, if you Googled Samuel Huntington Congress, you would come to it immediately. I would start with that. It is a profound piece. The political scientist James Burnham, who wrote several famous books, such as The Managerial Revolution and The Machiavellians in the 1940s. In the late 1950s, he wrote a book called Congress and the American Future. I would recommend that book. There is an essay by another eminent late professor of the old school named Wilmore Kendall called The Two Majorities, and it is about the majority that constitutes Article I and the majority that constitutes Article II, and how they are different, and how our freedoms depend upon a tension between the two rather than one running roughshod over the others. So I would begin with those pieces by Huntington, Burnham, and Wilmore Kendall. There are a lot of modern books on the Congress, and there are some very good ones, but I think stepping back a little bit and looking at some of the classics in the field are good. And while we're at it, the Federalist Papers aren't bad either.
I should say so. Well, that's a great list, and thank you for indulging me there right on the spot. I think we're running out of time, so I just wanted to sort of close with this. In April, you won the Bradley Prize. Congratulations.
Thank you.
The Bradley Foundation is, of course, committed to preserving and defending the institutions of free representative government and private enterprise. During your acceptance remarks, you stated, quote, "Institutions are being disestablished by the forces of modernity, but we should not despair that they are irretrievably in decay." Ultimately, why is it the case, and why should we be hopeful as Americans about restoring the institution of Congress to its proper role?
The word to look for here is not hope. Hope is too easy. Mm-hmm. The institutions, we should care about these institutions for the very simple reason that we are a very successful society and constitutional enterprise. We're the oldest running constitution of the success and prosperity that ours has had. Most successful polities do not last 200 years. Mm-hmm. Ours is still doing very, very well. The society, for all of its problems, is quite prosperous, progressive. You can see all sorts of good signs. Our government is in something of a ditch, And we can blame it on Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump or Chuck Schumer or Mitch McConnell. But there are reasons to be worried about our institutions, regardless of our particular views about right policy. And what I was trying to say in my Bradley remarks is that aside from immediate politics, aside from our immediate political prejudices, we have some serious institutional problems. And our founders were institutionalists. They had a lot of disagreements, but they could come together, but they succeeded in coming together on setting up some institutions that have endured. And we have lots and lots of examples of successful institution building in almost every decade of the American experience. I think that our continued success depends on looking at our institutions. And it is always possible to describe institutional problems as being so deep that they can never be fixed.
Right.
And I've written all sorts of papers that if you people read my papers and say, I'm in despair because the problem seems so deep that what's the point? Well, for me to say, well, I am hopeful, that's not quite the right attitude. The attitude is you want to understand the problems as a preliminary for finding out how to fix it.
I see.
And it is, and I really don't care about being optimistic or pessimistic, mm-hmm. because we're basically Americans, and it's in our DNA that if you've got a problem, you don't ask yourself, am I hopeful or not? I mean, a lot of the good things in America have come from people going out to do things that were completely hopeless.
Right.
So I think that the great thing we've got going for us is the American can-do spirit, and I don't want to preach about that because I think it's something that we all want to do. So my job is identify the problems, mm-hmm. not to wring our hands over them, but to find our way forward. And I have these modest little ideas. I'm not trying to say I've written a really interesting paper, therefore I'm in charge of the solution. But I can see a couple of things,
sure.
like making Congress much more hierarchical. And, you know, I want to bring back autocratic committee chairmen. I want to have a Congress that can stand up in the battle of the separation of powers. I want a big, noisy debate about having a big deficit-funded welfare state. And we live in a world where there are a lot of welfare states. There are a lot of welfare states, for example, the Scandinavian ones, the Canadian one up north of ours. They're not perfect. They borrow more than they should. But essentially, they have welfare states that are being funded out of current tax revenues. Mm-hmm. If they can do it, we can do it, right? So
right.
So we shouldn't say, you know, it's impossible. These are big problems, but they're worthy problems. And so we should get on with them.
Agreed. Well, clearly you have so much to offer us on these topics, and we'll have to have you back again to discuss them soon. On behalf of the Federal Society's Article 1 Initiative, thank you, Chris, for joining us
today. Nate, thank you very much for having me.
Thank you for listening to Necessary and Proper. If you enjoyed this podcast, please tell a friend, and don't forget to subscribe on iTunes or Google Play. To learn more about the Article 1 Initiative, please visit fedsoc.org/articlei. That's fedsoc.org/articlei.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.